Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spungin. On today's show... Listener, on today's episode, we'll be visiting the Parliament of the Jewish People, discussing the disappearance of European Jewry, weighing in on the Trump administration's fight against Jew hatred, and asking whether Borat Tsagdaev could win a Jewish Nobel for his creator, Sacha Baron Cohen. In a little while, we'll be calling up Adrian Hennigan to talk about Borat's subsequent movie film, QAnon, and Rudy Giuliani's troublesome shirt tales. But first, joining me in the studio, it's a pleasure to welcome Judy Maltz. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Simon.
Hi, how the heck are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Good.
And you?
Good, yeah. My standard response is, all things considered, pretty
exactly.
good. Pretty
exactly.
good. So, Judy, it's been quite a dramatic week at the World Zionist Congress, popularly known as the Parliament of the Jewish People.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, can you tell us exactly what the World Zionist Congress is, who it represents, and why it's important, if it is?
Okay, well, the World Zionist Congress is an organization that predates the State of Israel by many, many years.
Mm.
And as you said, it is supposed to be the parliament of the Jewish people. Jewish people around the world elect or choose delegates to this Congress. And the members of this Congress are the ones who choose the chief positions in what we call the national institutions, which really aren't national because they don't belong to one specific nation like Israel, but they're the Jewish nation's institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the World Zionist Organization, the Jewish Agency, Keren HaYesod, and really what's most important of all, which is affiliated with the World Zionist Organization, is Keren Kayemet Lisrael, the Jewish National Fund.
Okay, which I'm sure all of our listeners have heard of. They've seen the little blue boxes.
Right, and of course somebody must have planted a tree in their name in Israel at some point and donated mm-hmm. a dollar or two to the Jewish National Fund for that purpose. And the Jewish National Fund is really the most important of these organizations because it owns so much land in Israel. It controls billions of dollars worth of land in the country. And so that is really the big gem inside this whole world Jewish organizational forum.
Mm. Just to be clear, and sorry to interrupt you, but when we say that it's the parliament of the Jewish people, we mean those Jewish people who support Zionism, right? And we know that there are a growing number of Jews who don't, but this is the World Jewish Zionist Parliament, so to speak.
Presumably, okay? And we will get back to that,
okay.
Because it really wasn't exactly that case this year when we had one major new party in there, a brand new party that isn't actually a Zionist party, but we will get to that. So the way it works is that the World Zionist Congress this year, for example, every year it's a little bit different, but this year it had 521 delegates.
Mm. It meets every 5 years?
Every 5 years mm-hmm. in Jerusalem. This was obviously the first time it couldn't be held in Jerusalem because of the coronavirus, so it was held online. About a third of the delegates are American, and they are elected in elections, proper elections. About the third of the delegates are from Israel, and they are chosen on the basis they represent Israeli political parties. They're supposed to represent the size of this particular party in the Israeli Knesset. And the rest, the other third, is from all over the world, mm-hmm. and they are chosen or elected in all sorts of ways. So it's one-third, one-third, and one-third. And they choose the top jobs in those organizations, as I said. And so whichever block is stronger, whether it's the right-wing religious block or the left-wing center progressive block, if they have more delegates, they can control those very important institutions.
And so what was all the drama about this week, Judy?
So here's the story. First, we have to understand what precipitated all this. Generally, in the World Zionist Congress, there has always been a slight majority of what we'd call center-left parties and progressive movements. When I say progressive movements, I'm talking about the Reform and the Conservative movement as opposed to the Orthodox. Because that is really who has the majority in the Jewish world, okay, which is a little different than Israel, where here the Orthodox have a lot more power and the right wing have a lot more power. But let's look at the United States now. We know 70% of American Jews vote Democrat, right? Considering that one-third of the seats in the World Zionist Congress are American, so it makes sense that there would be a slight majority of the left, center-left, and progressive parties. And there's always been what we call this sort of gentleman's agreement in the World Zionist Congress, that no matter who has the majority, we try to distribute the jobs evenly between the different blocks so that everybody in the Jewish world can feel that they are represented and they have a voice in these institutions. This year, for the first time, there was a slight majority to the right wing and religious parties and movements. And why did that happen? Okay. Most of the Jewish world was paying attention over the past year to a certain phenomena in the American Jewish world, was that, and this phenomena had to do with the center-left. There were a lot of center-left groups that said, enough with the national institutions channeling money into the West Bank settlements and causes we don't believe in. We have got to have a bigger voice at the table. And they went, and then there was this new party. It's not actually new, but it is a coalition of a lot of different parties that came together called Hatikva, which represented the center-left American progressives. And they did a really huge voter recruitment campaign to get more and more center-left Jews to vote in these elections and have a voice. And they actually did really well. Okay.
And who is eligible to vote in these elections?
Any Jewish person over the age of 18. It's very, very easy. So they got, you know, a lot of people to vote for this Hatikva slate,
which, as you say, is left-leaning.
Left-leaning, center-left, two-state solution, well, it's not actually Reform and Conservative, but many progressive-minded, because the Reform and Conservative movements have their own designated parties. So they did really well, and there was a lot of buzz about this Hatikva party. What people weren't paying attention to was another phenomena that was happening more under the radar. And that was a new party called Eretz HaKodesh. This was a Haredi party, but not ultra-Orthodox anti-Zionist, more think Chabad.
Okay.
Not exactly Zionist. Chabad would not describe themselves as Zionist, but they are extremely right-wing when it comes to political policies in Israel. So very, very much in favor of annexing the West Bank settlements and greater land of Israel, and very, very Orthodox.
And this is a new party?
Brand new party. Okay, non-Zionist, very right-wing, and very religious. They are affiliated in Israel with Yahadut HaTorah, United Torah Judaism, which is the Ashkenazi Haredi party in the Knesset. And they also did a massive voter recruitment drive, and they emerged as the third largest party in the election.
Behind?
Behind the Reform movement and another Orthodox party. Okay? So they were the big surprise. Yeah, everyone was talking about Hatikva and Hatikva and Hatikva, and then suddenly out of nowhere, a party called Eretz HaKodesh, a Haredi right-wing party, is the third largest, capturing, I think it was 15% of the total vote. And they tipped the balance. So that the first time in the World Zionist Congress, you had a slight majority of right-wing and religious delegates.
But there's a gentleman's agreement in place whereby, even with a small majority one way or another, this doesn't change the jobs for the boys and girls, and it's they try to keep it equitable, right?
You would have thought.
Well, you just told us that.
Well, that's how it's always been.
Okay.
Okay, so something very fundamental changed here. And all the parties in this new right-wing religious bloc got together and put together an agreement on how we're going to divvy up all the jobs. The only thing they forgot to include in this little agreement was any real positions of influence for anyone on the center left.
Mm.
And that is what precipitated all this.
Unfortunate oversight, I'm sure.
Unfortunate oversight. But as you can see, things changed over the course of the week.
Right. There was an outcry. I was reading your reports, obviously, about an outcry over the hostile takeover, I think it was referred to
there
as.
That is exactly how they described what was happening. Now, a lot of pressure was put on leaders of the World Zionist Organization. And there was some very intense negotiations that took place. At one point, the center-left and progressive movements were threatening even to withdraw from the World Zionist Organization and set up their own competing organization. At one time, they were threatening to have some of the organizations which don't usually vote on these matters to actually exercise their right to vote. All these were pressure tactics, and in the end, they did pay off. But in the end, the right and the religious parties are still the dominant ones in these so-called national institutions.
And what kind of compromise did they reach? The sort of compromise where no one's happy?
I think the compromise is that the center, left, and progressive movements got a few more jobs than they were supposed to have gotten to begin with, but nothing really major. Keren Kayemet, as I said, the most important organization in this whole affiliation of national institutions. Keren Kayemet was, for the past 4 or 5 years, headed by a representative of the Labor Party. Okay. And of course, Labor Party is all but doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
So there was no way that the Labor Party was going to head it. There had been talk at one point, blue and white, Kahol Levan wanted to take control of Keren Kayemet, but no. It's going to be headed by rotation agreement between a representative of the World Likud and a representative of the World Mizrahi. Mizrahi is the national religious party, and there's a whole coalition of religious parties who are going to run it. So that is no longer in the hands of the center left. What did they get? They got a woman representative, still not clear who it will be, who will head the so-called Zionist movement. Now ask me, what is the Zionist movement?
Judy, what's the Zionist movement?
Well, I just learned there is such a thing called the Zionist movement.
Okay.
It's been pretty defunct for many years, but it now has this renaissance so that they could appoint a woman from the center left to head it. And the real benefit of this position is if you head the Zionist movement, you get to be buried in Har Herzl in the section of the cemetery reserved for dignitaries.
You have to die first, of course.
Of course.
But what a benefit. Judy, is this about influence? Is this about power? Is this about a job with a salary? Or can the people who are appointed to head these institutions actually affect policy change here in Israel?
So some of these jobs are salaried, and they're pretty nice salaries.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them are. So that explains why everyone wants these jobs for their people. Some of the jobs are non-salary, but, you know, there's this prestige associated with them. Like I said, World Zionist Organization, here's one of the big stories that nobody's talking about. Mm. There is one position in the World Zionist Organization which is very significant, and nobody has really reported about this yet. We're going to have a big story in a day or two, so keep posted on Haaretz to see how this develops. But within the World Zionist Organization, there's a division for diaspora affairs. The person who runs that division is in charge of all sorts of projects that are meant to create bridges between Israel and diaspora Jewish communities. And until now, this division was headed by a woman named Gusti Yoshua Braverman, who was a representative of the Reform Movement. In other words, she's from the progressive, the center-left progressive bloc.
Which makes sense if the majority of diaspora Jews belong to the progressive camp, right?
Yes, of course. Well, Gusti will not have that job anymore, and the job has been given to a representative of Likud. The representative of Likud who will get this job is a man named Jacques Kupfer. He's a French Jew, a leader of the Likud in France, but a very, very extreme right-wing ideologue. Mm. What I am hearing is that even within Likud circles, he is considered beyond the pale. He's a major fundraiser for the settlements in Hebron and Kiryat Arba. He has often referred to left-wing Israelis as traitors. He does not recognize a Palestinian people.
Well, he's in good company with the current Israeli government on that one.
That's true, but can you imagine, who is he actually going to be talking to in the diaspora who's going to want to sit with someone like that? So this is a very interesting appointment, and we will hopefully be running a piece in the next day or so exposing exactly who Jacques Kupfer is and what he stands for.
In what way does this whole episode, this whole brouhaha over the who controls the institutions of world Zionism, does this in any way reflect the state of relations between Israel and the diaspora?
I would say very much so. If you look at what's happened in the past few years, all the crises that we've had between Israel and the diaspora world have centered on the progressive Jews of the world, reform, conservative, those who favor a two-state solution, who don't like the extreme right wing, feeling shunted, feeling as if they are not welcome in Israel, and if their voices should not be heard. And again, what we saw happen this week is very much gave them that feeling again. And it's not a coincidence that in a very unusual letter that leaders of some of these organizations sent to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu the morning of the pivotal vote on this agreement, they said to him, "You made a huge mistake with the Kotel deal. You know what a wedge that drove in relations between Israel and the diaspora. Do not repeat this mistake. You are liable to repeat that mistake if you allow the agreement as is to go through."
And Netanyahu had the power to stop or just influence to try and thwart it?
He was definitely involved behind the scenes in moderating this agreement and getting some concessions put in that would satisfy the center-left and the non-orthodox movements.
And it's not just the left-right divide, right? It's the reform conservative slash orthodox. And you mentioned the Kotel agreement. And, you know, the egalitarian prayer space is not a question of left or right. It's a question of egalitarian prayer for Jews of all denominations. So this really does cross party political and even ideological lines as well.
Although the non-orthodox movements, at least in the World Zionist Congress, tend to be aligned always with the center-left parties. And the orthodox and ultra-orthodox tend to be aligned with the right-wing parties, which makes sense, right? Even though not every conservative Jew supports merits, right?
Right, right.
But that's the way these blocks were organized, at least this time.
And it seems to be just reinforcing those blocks when the divisions are so clear between the left and the right, between the orthodox and the non-orthodox, the non-O, we'll call them.
Right.
And that just seems to be exacerbating these tensions between Israel and the diaspora.
Exactly.
Yeah, Judy, in the middle of all of this, you somehow found time to report this week about a new study by the London-based Institute for Jewish Policy Research, which, if I'm reading it correctly, pretty much heralds the end of Europe as a major center of Jewish life. Is that fair?
Well, if you look at the figures, what's absolutely amazing is the share of world Jewry based in Europe today is the same as it was pretty much 1,000 years ago. And that's after they had almost been near 90% at the turn of the 20th century. So, yes, but we have to think. I mean, what happened here is not that Jews are fleeing London or Paris or Rome. I mean, maybe many are leaving. But the bulk who left were from the former Soviet Union. And we know when that happened. That was in the 90s when we're talking about 60% who, well, we know, of course, 6 million were lost in the Holocaust.
Of course.
So that was a huge loss. But the interesting thing was that in the past 50 years, we've seen a drop of 60% in the percentage based in Europe. But that was mainly because we had, you know, 1.5 million, maybe closer to 2 million Jews leave the former Soviet Union and Eastern European countries.
Right.
So they didn't die, thankfully. You know, they weren't killed. They just moved elsewhere.
Mm. Does this decline in the importance, or certainly the numerical importance of Europe from a Jewish perspective, does this put added pressure on the already strained relations between U.S. Jews and Israel, which appear to be heading in very different directions, certainly in terms of support for Trump? As you mentioned earlier, and as Alison Kaplan Summer reported last week, 70% of Americans plan to vote for Biden, while we know that if Israelis could vote, Trump would win by a landslide.
Well, I guess when we talk about world Jewry now, or the Jewish diaspora, as a result of these numbers, we're really only talking about North America, or more precisely, the United States.
Right.
That's world Jewry, because there are so few Jews left in Europe. We're talking about 1.3 million.
Right.
So, yes, in a way, they have become so marginal.
Mm. Judy, before we move on to the cultural section of this episode, I was wondering whether you personally were relieved that the Trump administration is finally taking serious action against some of the most virulently, rabidly, dangerously anti-Semitic organizations currently spewing their venom. I'm talking, of course, about the State Department proposal to brand Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and Oxfam as anti-Semitic. We've gone through the looking glass on this one, right?
So I'll tell you, you know what did relieve me? That the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, rushed to put out a condemnation of that. That was reassuring, because the ADL represents mainstream Jewry, and they saw right through this.
Right. If even the ADL is against it, then it must be dead in the water, right?
Right.
Well, one would hope.
One would hope, yes.
So somebody who's making jokes at the expense of anti-Semites, rather than making a mockery of the battle against anti-Semitism, is comedian and actor Sacha Baron Cohen. Judy, will you stay with us as we dial up Adrian Hennigan, Haaretz's reviewer-in-chief, to discuss Baron Cohen's latest movie?
Of course.
Excellent. So let's hear a jingle and we'll be right back. Hi, Adrian. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Simon. Yeah, how's it going?
Yeah, pretty good. Judging by your prolific output of reviews on Haaretz.com, Adrian, I'd say you're one of the few people who might actually be enjoying all these lockdowns.
Well,
maybe not.
Yeah, I'm not sure about enjoying, but
surviving.
I mean, it's kind of become my coping mechanism. You know, I kind of, at the beginning, I was just getting, you know, deeper into the wormhole of reading the depressing stories about COVID, and I think I needed something to help me escape from that, and it turned out that watching television 24/7 was a good way of doing that.
Who knew? Who knew?
Indeed, yeah.
Literally, you've reviewed dozens of shows and movies in the past few weeks, including Sacha Baron Cohen's long-awaited sequel to the 2006 Borat movie. It's called Borat's Subsequent Movie Film, and it's now streaming on Amazon Prime. Adrian, remind our listeners who Borat is and why McDonald Trump called Baron Cohen a creep.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Borat, or to give him his full name, Borat, Margaret Sagdaev, he's like the ultimate fish out of water character, really. Kind of uses his faux innocence and faux stupidity to ensnare actually genuinely stupid people. And he's just, I mean, I didn't realize, to be honest, until I started researching for the film last week, how long, you know, Borat has been around. It's like nearly 25 years in various guises. Like, he started off as this, he was a Moldovan, I think, originally, and then a Albanian, and then in the late 90s, Sacha Baron Cohen discovered that Cossack was the best way to have this sort of dumb journalist called Borat. And I do wonder how Kazakhstan has handled it over the years, having this the most well-known Kazakh person being this buffoon. It can't be that pleasant for them.
Judy, have you seen the movie yet?
I haven't yet.
You saw the original?
Yes, yes, of course.
Listen, I got to say, I laughed out loud from the opening credits. I was reminded that Baron Cohen's production company is called 4x2 Films, a nod to Cockney rhyming slang for anybody who still remembers that. Adrian, The Guardian describes the movie as an artful mix of agitprop, fly-on-the-wall reportage and stunt comedy. Given the timing of the movie's release, just days before the US presidential election, is it first and foremost an anti-Trump mockumentary?
I would say it's more a pro-voting movie than an anti-Trump, but obviously the film is very anti-Trump. Mm. But just to go back a little bit to the fact that his company calls his company 4x2 Films,
yeah,
is like, to me, it's an embodiment of who Sacha Baron Cohen is, because he takes this perjurative term that, you know, British Jews would have heard people say over the years, and he takes that and owns it.
Right.
And it's almost like, and that's what Borat does as well with his kind of his inside jokes, so that ultimately here is this Jewish performer making the most outrageous anti-Semitic jokes, literally, because he is perhaps the only person who could do these things. You know, it's like you wouldn't, you know, Jerry Seinfeld might be able to, but it's like he will never be that edgy.
Mm.
And so it's just, it's fascinating to see what he gets away with. But in terms of Trump, I mean, it's amazing because, you know, with this and Who is America in 2018, his last TV series, it's like there are so many willing fools that who will just walk into this trap that Sacha Baron Cohen sets for them. You know, people like Roy Moore and, you know, just this whole parade of Republicans. I mean, Rudy Giuliani being the most famous one in Borat now, being sort of caught with his trousers down or with his hand in a strange place in his pants.
Yeah, not quite his trousers down.
Yes, but if we're giving him a bit longer, who knows? but yeah, I'd say it's really, I mean, obviously the timing of the film, they wanted it to come out before November the 3rd. And, I mean, the fact that they rush released it before the presidential debate last week was also telling. That it's just like, yeah, we want you to vote, and then the very end message of the film is, you know, now go vote or be executed.
Right, yes.
So, you know, they're not being subtle about what they want the film to do.
It's a Baron Cohen's, I don't know whether to call it Holocaust humour or Holocaust denial humour. This is a continuation of his campaign in real life, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah. But I think what he's done really well, and I think over the years how he's matured, is that in the past, I think when Borat came out in 2006, the movie, he would only do interviews in character.
Mm.
And now, I think he's owning some of the things we see on the screen. So the fact in the movie, there's a huge scene, and for me, a really powerful one, where he goes into a synagogue and meets the Holocaust survivor, and Judith, Tim Evans, and it's a really touching scene. But he's recognizing that in itself isn't enough, and that he's now, you know, as Sacha Baron Cohen, using his power and his voice to target people like Facebook and the Holocaust deniers of this world, and seeing that, you know, a movie ultimately isn't going to change anyone's mind. You know, I can't think of the last movie that's shifted the dial one way or another, but a person leading a campaign on something on the modern form of communication like Facebook or Twitter, as is his preferred model, is the way to go.
And he was successful.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, Facebook, just a few days ago, revamped its policy on Holocaust denial, right?
Yeah, and you go on his Twitter page, and like his big banner is the Stop Hate for Profit campaign that he's completely endorsed, and you know, he's taking ownership, I think, and that's just great to see.
I remember 14 years ago when the original movie came out.
I wish I could remember that long ago.
14 years? Oh, wow.
So Abe Foxman, and we're going to give another shout out for the ADL here. Abe Foxman had issues with Borat, saying that some people might not realise that the running of the Jew, for example, isn't a real thing. Is there a danger that Baron Cohen's ironic espousal of some of the most abhorrent ideologies could be missed?
I think that's why he's now, you know, adding his own voice to the mix. Because you're right, I don't think anybody out there is going to watch Borat and suddenly make Borat a poster child for the far right. Because, you know, we know it's a joke, and let's hope that the world isn't so far gone that people actually will take Borat seriously.
Right, but it is a pretty serious movie, though, right?
Even
as you're laughing at, you know, the anti-Semitic cake, you're appalled at the implication and the blasé compliance of the bakery owner.
Yeah, to me it was like, it's a seriously worrying movie, because that scene with the anti-Semitic cake is just jaw-dropping. Mm. Yeah, you know, it's like that, and then there's another scene where Borat is asking about a propane gas canister and what size he needs to gas 20 gypsies, and the guy is helping him, and it's like this horrible complicity that you see that people have, and you never know quite if anyone is in on the joke, but you never really get the sense that they are. It's just this horrible compliance that they have, and unwillingness to question the most horrid, horrid views that people have. Mm. But what for me was interesting was that, you know, we talk about if this is an anti-Trump movie or not. And I think we know that if you're a Trump fan, you're a Trump fan to the end, and no movie is ever going to change your mind. I mean, there have been quite a few films in recent weeks, documentaries,
right,
like Totally Under Control, which looks at Trump's handling of the coronavirus crisis. And it's like all of these things that it's like the QAnon characters in the film, who you would think are sort of fictitious. And I mean, literally, I was watching the end and I thought there were going to be a couple of names that come up here as actors, because I cannot believe these people are real. But they are real, and they're fascinating characters, because on the one hand, what they're saying is repulsive. You know, the whole, you know, mm-hmm. the Clintons are evil, and their views are abhorrent. But then on the other hand, they've literally taken in the stranger, mm-hmm. this guy, this immigrant, and let him into their home for 5 days, and are treating him with this incredible warmth and kindness, which is like such a confusing message, and just shows the complexity of life that we sometimes gloss over with our kind of blinkered partisanship.
Mm. There is a lot of dissonance in this film, certainly. It's hard to laugh out loud when your jaw is on the ground.
Yeah.
So this Baron Cohen, he might not win an Oscar for this performance.
Or he might.
He might. But,
I hope the girl playing his daughter does. She's fantastic.
She was wonderful. But he is, however, making a late surge in the race to win the so-called Jewish Nobel. he's one of several candidates for the Genesis Prize, along with people like Steven Spielberg, Barbara Streisand, Rabbi Jonathan Sachs. No nomination for Jared or Ivanka, I noticed. Who would your money be on?
Well, I'll let Judy go first. She's far more of an expert than I am on this.
Judy, who's your tip for the Jewish Nobel this year?
Oh, gosh, can you...
Well, we have Justice Eleanor Kagan.
Yeah.
Barbara Streisand, Steven Spielberg, Jonathan Sachs. I think Gal Gadot was also one of the nominees. It's a tough competition. I wouldn't put any money on it, to be honest.
Yeah.
I would put money on Sacha Baron Cohen not winning. But,
That's for sure.
And Barbara Streisand, because she's too anti-BB. But yeah, a safe pair of hands like Jonathan Sachs.
Jonathan Sachs would be a safe bet, you're right.
Steven Spielberg, no. He might say something that would offend BB as well.
Well,
easily done.
We will bring you the results of that when they're announced early next year, listener. We're going to have to wrap it up there, I'm afraid, guys.
Okay.
Thank you, Adrian, for joining us.
No, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you to Judy Maltz.
My pleasure.
And, of course, to Aaron Ehrlich, our producer. Join us again next time for another episode of Haaretz Weekly. Until then, shalom from Tel Aviv.